Welcome back to Art Matters, the podcast for artists. My guest today is Catherine Howe. Catherine is a New York-based artist who has exhibited throughout the United States and Europe for over 30 years, including exhibitions at the Corcoran Gallery of Art in Washington, D.C., MoMA PS1 in New York, and the Albright Knox Art Gallery in Buffalo. Her work has been reviewed by Art in America, Art Forum, Art Critical, The New York Times, The New Yorker, and the LA Times, too. And more important than all of that, she was my favorite professor in grad school. Today, Catherine and I discuss color, mise en place, gallery requests, speed, snark, pressure, ecstatic practice, tuning out chatter, a crisis of confidence, resilience and change, enjoying contradictions, trust, gratitude, and the three types of studio visits from hell. For all my listeners in the LA area, her upcoming exhibition, Wallflower, opens May 18th at Von Lintel Gallery in Los Angeles and runs through July 6th. I highly recommend checking this one out. Opening reception for Wallflower is Saturday, May 18th from 4 to 7. Now on to the show. Okay, we're going to kick this off. Levels are looking pretty great. It's a little echoey in here, but you know, that's what happens when you're in a mausoleum of your own making. Wait, is mausoleum funeral that,
yeah, that's too funereal.
Sorry, a cathedral of your own devising. Yeah. Okay, I'm going to start with a softball. I want to talk to you about the switch from the last body of work to this one. And as always, I'm asking for a friend, who is me, because after working in black and white for so long, coming back to like full palette colors was really exciting, pretty daunting, and then most importantly, technically such a challenge to kind of like remember saturation amounts, blending, mixing, layering, like transparent, opaque. And I'm curious, and you do have to set the history correct, because I forget exactly when you were making the white-on-white pieces or the mostly white-on-white pieces, and then how long you've been in the space of color again. And yeah, that's the question. Take us through that, if you don't mind.
I'm just going to swerve in a slightly... I'm going to answer your question, but I'm going to kind of change the question before I answer it, which can be really annoying, but...
I'm open to it.
Get used to it.
Mm-hmm.
I see that, yes, there's been a shift into more fully blown color, which I was doing all along in my works on paper. So it's something I always valued, but the process of making the paintings is so caught up in determining what they look like. More traditional ways of painting involving all those things you say, such as mixing and layering, and it happens, but it happens in a kind of ass backwards way in my work, coming frequently out of printmaking techniques, so that I kind of stumble upon ways of working that determine what they look like. So I've been working for about 10 years now in rather, not all white on white, but monochromes involving interference pigments that go from silver to gold in the background that kind of read as a white or a light gray, but are activated by light and motion. But withholding any kind of local color, I love that description, local color, descriptive color, and having color function more kind of metaphorically or emotionally, never... Oh, I'm using red because the poppy, the flower I'm referring to is red. It's never about that. It's about color becoming almost a character in and of itself. So, and then there's surface treatments such as gilding with metal leaf and dumping beads onto the paint and all kinds of textural and surface treatments that confuse the notion of painting as mimesis, and it kind of pushes it into something else. So this new body of work is, on the one hand, different in that it has a kind of, do your listeners find it annoying when we're talking about all these things they can't see? Is it,
I haven't inquired yet, but, I am, probably a little bit, but it's not going to stop us because we're going to keep doing it. Maybe I'll take some pictures, put those online.
They can always go and easily find people's work.
One day this will become a video podcast.
I love the fact that we both get to wear our pajamas while we do this, though. And we couldn't do that if we had the video on. So the color. All right, you want the truth instead? That just erase everything I just said. The truth was the gallerist came. Tara Von Lintel. This is where the work is going for the show in Von Lintel. And she looked at my monotypes. She's like, she likes the monochrome work. She likes the work I've been doing. But she really prefers the strong color and the pop sensibility of my monotypes. Catherine, can't you just do some paintings that are more like your monotypes? More like this. I want more of this. And when she left, I said no to myself. No, I'm not going to come up with something just because you want it. But then I went ahead, and that's exactly what I did. I used that challenge, that lemons lemonade equation, and I came up with a way of making these paintings to kind of pretty much answer her dream of what she wanted.
It's so interesting. I'm really glad you fleshed that out more, because is that a compromise that made you uncomfortable, or like the lemon to lemonade thing, or like, did it feel that way on first blush? And then immediately after you were like, nope, that's actually an obstacle. That's like a challenge that I want to take on.
Exactly.
Someone pushing you in another direction is kind of like, yeah, why not?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Huh. Yeah. It's, and anything that encourages you or stimulates you to grow or change or shift, it's not always a good thing, but in my case, it was a good thing. It's like, well, why not give this gallery what she wants? I mean, it's a reciprocal relationship. She's putting on a show of my work. She really responds to this aspect of my work more than others. Why not try to fulfill that request? And it's something that is not like it's something that I hadn't thought of for myself as well. I mean, it was something that seemed like an organic, exciting thing to do anyway. Mm-hmm. So why not? For a couple of weeks, I said, no, I can't do that. But then I just kind of went ahead and tried.
There's actually, this is like a perfect segue into another question I have for you, but I actually am going to come back around to it. Because I want to stick, because there's a question I'm sort of desperate to ask you. So you, that's still about the paintings, I mean. So going from the, what'd you call them, monochromatic, not white paintings, I don't want to be reductive, but going from that to the full color spectrum, what do you think, how does the function of a painting of yours change when color gets involved? And I'll give you a very like specific question, and maybe we can go from there, which is for the white on whites, I think the gesture and the surface has so much percentage of the functionality, okay? Because the volumetric areas, the three-dimensional, all that create shadows, the subtleties, the nuance of one white against another white, the reflection versus the opacity, all of that. Then when color is introduced, of course, I think my question is, when color is introduced, it becomes like much more is happening on every painting. And I wonder, does that make the gesture less important, meaning taking less of a percentage of the overall function of a painting because you're taking in these other criteria? Or is that way too much analysis and it is all, we haven't gotten into how fast you work, but is the gesture just with color on the new paintings? And therefore it's not really more impactful, less impactful, more important, less important. Does that make sense? Or yeah. If I lost you, that's fine too.
No, you didn't lose me. No, that makes a lot of sense. The answer is mostly no to your question. It goes back to process. First of all, color in general is part of all the paintings, whether it's an iridescent white on white or a rainbow-like spectrum of yellow, red, and blue on top
Correct.
Of black.
Yeah, I understand.
It's all color. Mm-hmm. It's just different types of color and different systems of color. But the process determines so much of how they look that it's like there's a setup. The setup is I put down certain colors, but the process of the gesture is the thing that makes the colors happen in the painting. And if you don't mind, I'll explain what I mean by that, because that sounds really vague, really vague. The color is put down in a somewhat systematic way at the bottom. Well, first there's the layer. First there's the field layer, which are a number of layers, which is similar to my older work in that it's iridescent or interference micropigment.
And that's the color. Sorry to interrupt, but that's the color that goes across the entire rectangle or square. That's the underlayer, right?
That's the field, the underlayer.
Okay.
Yeah, the base. That's like maybe three layers of either the same or different reflective. Base colors, the base. Then, and this is where the printmaking and the kind of procedural way of painting happens. Then there are layers of mostly transparent, mostly pure pigment that is rolled on with brayers. And then while that's wet, it's the gesture on top itself, which is fulfilled in white paint, that picks up the color in a semi-random way, so that the gesture is still primary. The gestural drawing, I'll call it drawing. It's not just gesture. I'm referring to and drawing things from nature, flower, floral, animal, still life, et cetera, et cetera. There's imagery happening, and that gestural imagery is dragging the color from underneath as it's happening. So it's still not like normal painting with color. It's
right.
Still,
you're not making sort of decisions, maybe the decisions that some of the listeners would regard to like formal decisions about color.
Oh, I'm making plenty of formal decisions about color, but I'm making them ahead of time when I'm laying down when I'm laying down what's underneath. It's all very considered and, you know.
So therefore, to wrap back to my question, while all the color, I'll say there's more color or it's more saturated, you know, whatever you like. But the gesture kind of, because you haven't changed your process so much, it seems like the gesture or the drawing component hasn't really changed. Like it's still got the same level of importance, sits on the same level of the surface. It is ostensibly the same.
Imagery. Yeah.
As before.
Yeah.
So it's, I get it. Can I ask you about speed? I know that you use only acrylics. Am I right in thinking that the drawing / gesture component part of the painting is you have to do it quick?
You are correct.
How quick? Are we talking, they're all one day paintings? Are we even talking about like a matter of minutes or an hour? Like how quick are these movements and how much like pressure, is there pressure to make what you need to make?
There is exquisite pressure.
Exquisite. Oh my goodness.
So there are aspects of this work that are extremely slow, building up the layers underneath, waiting. There's the, you know, decision making involving choosing which colors are going underneath to be later dragged up. I have to set up my, what do chefs call it? Mise-en-scene, you know, where they have
mise-en-place.
Yeah. I have to have everything ready.
I just used that word literally last night, and now I'm really questioning my situation right now that I've said that word twice in 2 days.
I like to bring out the best in people. So So there's a kind of like chef's setup where I have to have everything I need nearby. I have the pre-mixed, the colors that I've decided to use. But then as you suspected, the final action-packed event, the arena in which to act, so to speak, must take place in about 2 hours. I have to say, I'm not annoyed with you, Isaac, but I am annoyed sometimes that people seem to put so much emphasis on how long did it take you to make that? You know, that sort of, was it Sargent who it was Whistler. Who gave the snarky answer like a lifetime? You know.
But, such as, I don't know, but that is such a snarky answer.
No, but speed, clearly speed is part of the subject matter here. Like there's a kind of fluidity and everything happening at the same time. Like this happened is kind of what they say. It's clearly not something that's slowly brought up and considered, and there's no editing.
Yeah, I want to talk to you about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can tell there's no editing.
There's no editing. And because of that, there is a pile. You know, I have 3 acres. There's the back acre has this...
Dead paintings?
It's a joke. It's a joke.
So let me tell you why I ask, because I think that there are a number of questions like that are really solid for... If this doesn't simplify things too much, maybe people will disagree. But I think that there are certain categories that sort of... categories under which certain artists fall based on the speed with which they work. The different, it's kind of like the different building practices of a painting. And so therefore getting into an artist's mind, understanding the questions I'm going to ask you later on, I think it's good for, it helps build the relatability when you answer certain questions about the day-to-day, the studio practice, when people say, oh, she works at this speed, or, oh, she's one of those joyful painters versus one of those Midwestern depressive painters. Like, all of these things, while they're sort of cliche and probably properly so, I think we kind of do fall into these types. Like, and it's also interesting how you think about them yourself, because Amina, our mutual friend, calls me a really fast painter. And then when I'm making a painting, I feel so slow. You know, these things are, I think, subjective in an interesting way. But I still take your point, and it is, you know, 30 years in the making.
No, but I don't mean to discount the relevancy and brilliance of your question, too, because it is of the essence of this work that it must take place in a single session. The surface of it happens in a single session. The buildup does not. So there's a performance aspect to it. It must go right. It must go well. It's self-determining. I'm not looking at something while I'm working. There's no sketch nearby. There's no photograph nearby. This is happening in real time, and it's coming from me, and it's dependent upon me, and it's my body in space, and they are kind of physical. The larger ones, I'm having to move around, you know, 360 around the canvas. There is an orientation, a bottom and a top, but I will have to move my body significantly around to get at it. And I am fighting time, because as you know, the paint will dry. And if it starts to dry, all is lost. I mean, all is lost. It's over. Like, I have to stop. I have to stop before that happens. So it's self-limiting as well. Like, yeah. Well, I love that. I love the fact that it has a beginning and an end, and either it succeeds or it doesn't. It does feel like a thrilling high-wire act.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot I want to dig into there, but let's start with exquisite pressure. So... you remind me talking to, I think it would have been the last episode as of right now, which was Jen Hitchings. And she's an LA-based artist who does these landscapes. And she was talking about how the sort of infinitesimally small detail on the waterfalls, in different parts, but mostly the waterfalls, she kind of avoids until she has to do them because they're kind of like one take painting parts. And therefore, the way she described it is, of course, there's a fun to it. There's a sort of extreme fun, but there is also pressure and there's also anxiety. So what place in your practice, and we can talk about that top layer that we were just describing, where does pressure and anxiety live in this studio? And of course, we can say deadlines, and that's something I want to talk to you about. That's a question that I have for a little bit later. So I'm asking more specifically about the building of the painting, but you could also answer it in terms of the daily practice, you know, coming in. Where does anxiety or pressure live here and in you?
Well, as we have talked about before, and it's coming out, my show is called Wallflower. I mean, I've been isolated because of illness for a few years now. Although I'm feeling better and I'm coming out of it. I had a cancer diagnosis and I was in my studio. First, I was alone because of COVID, like everybody else, locked down. But then I had to further stay alone for like another year and a half because of my immune system being knocked out from the chemo. So the work in terms of anxiety, there's so much anxiety already, you know, in my life. Well, anybody's life, but as a cancer patient in particular. So the process, you know, my process has always been about kind of transcending the ordinary time and ordinary life, and possibly even transcending the kind of finite aspects of physical existence, almost like painting as a substitute for religious belief or ecstatic, some kind of ecstatic practice. I was raised Catholic school and all that, and I lost my religion somewhere along the line pretty early, about 14 probably. Ooh, that's the same time puberty hits, but that's another story. So there's a kind of desire for ecstatic knowledge that comes with working in a way where you don't know if you're going to succeed. You don't know if you're going to get something that's beautiful and exquisite or just really a mess. And the thrill of harnessing that uncertainty and dwelling in it, it's kind of like the discourse of the beautiful and the sublime. It's like the horrific aspects of the sublime, which include illness and the unknown. But then there's the brighter, shiny, beautiful aspects of the sublime, which edge towards the beautiful, where for even a moment, you feel like you can transcend yourself. You can transcend the ordinariness of yourself, of your body, of your existence. That's really heady stuff, and I should be embarrassed to even be talking about it, but it is the truth. Like that's what is sort of underlying my desire to work this way.
What about on days when you can't attach to it? So we were talking about drinking before we got on mic, and that you are, neither of us are drinking very much anymore, you more successfully than I. And I bring this up because what about the day when you wake up in the morning, or you used to wake up in the morning, you know, a little hungover from the night before, and you're faced again with the studio? And maybe a bunch of paintings, a couple of paintings that aren't working, maybe one that's showing some promise. And in moments like that, where whatever how the external has been internalized and you are a little loose, a little grumpy, a little hungover, when you can't attach to what you just said, you can't aspire to that level, are those days, are those non-functioning studio days, or have they been in the past? Or do you find a less heady workman-like philosophy that gets you from one end of the painting to the other end of the painting? Does that make sense?
It makes sense. I wish that worked for me, but the workman-like aspect of the work.
Yeah.
You know, I own the ideal that I described.
Yeah.
Is really the only way that these paintings can happen.
Interesting.
So if I'm not up to it.
You're not up to it.
If I'm not up to it that day, but it takes days and days and days to put down the underlayers. So I can be putting down, you know, because the underlayers is like a big knife, carefully applying it. It's got to be smooth. Like, so I can just build up underlayers. I can weed my garden. You know, I mean, there's plenty of, I can like answer emails. I mean, there's plenty of like administrative or boring or, you know, just workmanlike things to do in a studio practice and in being a so-called professional artist. There's plenty of other things to do. But the actual completion of the work has to happen in this kind of almost divine, you know, uplifted or without interest in the actual functioning of accomplishment. It's sort of outside of ordinary experience when it happens, when I work.
Yeah,
I have to summon it up.
So this next question I'm going to ask, it's a little nebulous, and I'm really only asking you because you were a teacher for so long. What do you do when you run into an artist, when you run into an artist who is earlier in their career, has a limited amount of time because of other jobs or this or that, and fits into the category that you just explained, which is you got to summon it. And if it's not there, you actually can't do it. Because this is another one of these categories that I see where, for me, I don't need much to go into the studio, need to feel much. Now, I have a huge problem with procrastination, with maybe anxiety. Different things stop me, but I don't need to feel much like working. It's more like I can trick my brain into working. But I know a lot of artists who would absolutely relate to how you just described it. So my question is this, knowing that that way of working limits your productivity, unless you can build up the underlayers and have sort of the mindless components, which you can do and therefore be very, very multitasking.
Which actually has been proven to not exist, but that's another story.
What do you tell, and what did you tell students who you ran into who were like you that could, you're teaching in a school. Everyone's got to get paintings done by crit day, la, la, la. So what do you tell people like you who need sort of everything to hit at the right time? To make their work. What do people like that do?
Well, I think that's true for most people, most artists, even if their work is dramatically different than mine. I think no matter what kind of work you're making, you kind of have to be in it and with it for it to be any good. There's always workmanlike things to do, busy work to do, but there's a kind of transcendence of distraction that must happen for everyone. So I guess, I've learned, like I said, summing it up. I mean, I've learned over the years, like, unless I'm really ill or something, I can make it happen. I can get myself into that state. I've learned to, you know, put myself there, by tuning out and purging all the chatter and bad stuff that gets in the way. So part of teaching this, you know, grad students who are, you know, serious students about their work, about their paintings was, it's almost like advocating for mental health in a way. It's like, learn to put aside your distractions, learn to prioritize, learn to set up a situation that allows you to function at a very high level, whatever that might be for you. I mean, it might be with music, without music, but having to turn away from the ordinary demands of life and put them aside quickly and clearly put them out of your mind for 2 hours, for 3 hours, for 4 hours, for 5 hours, for however many hours you're going to be working. It's a skill to learn how to prepare for beauty, prepare for work, prepare for the experience of making work. It's a skill to learn, as spooky as it all sounds. It really is almost like I'm coming in and I'm putting on my hat and I'm leaving putting other stuff at the door and I've got my hat on now and it's time to work. No one else is going to give you that. You have to take it for yourself.
Yeah, I take your point. So what about, is this a skill This is two questions, because I think the first one I know the answer to. Is a skill something that you've gotten better with over the years?
Yes.
And then the second question is, what are some, if you can share any, if they're not too idiosyncratic and purely your own, things that you've learned that have made this, to build this skill, to strengthen this muscle in you that like gets it going? Because I have to assume that you, like all the rest of us, you still have your ups and downs, you know, your dry periods, your very productive periods. Maybe that's inaccurate, but if you could speak to that as well as a few learned qualities that have helped in this area.
I don't allow myself to have dry periods or dead periods or how can I explain this? Over the years, I've learned to prioritize my, I hate the term studio practice, but I can't come up with anything better, so I'm going to use it. I've learned to prioritize it as if my life depends on it, because I figured out that it does. So, you know, after decades of working and falling flat on my face and having galleries betray me and feeling, you know, the ups and, like you said, the ups and downs of success and failure and success and failure, self-imposed frequently, this or self-judgment. I just finally, probably I was probably around 50 when this happened. I just finally hit a place where I just wasn't going to let anything else get in the way anymore. And I just wanted it badly enough. I wanted, you know, a really sublime, wonderful work experience for myself so badly that I just decided I wasn't going to let other things get in my way anymore. So it was really a kind of all or nothing desperation almost. Like I hit a desperate point. Part of it was also, I'm going to actually have to be honest about my teaching job to a certain degree. Getting this very demanding, very serious teaching job at the New York Academy of Art with the students who, you know, it's not something one takes lightly. It's a big responsibility and it's a privilege and all of that. It was when I first got that job, it was a much more conservative school than it is now. And it was full of realists who valued a kind of, mimesis and like they called it skill-based painting. And I was really the odd man out, the odd girl out when I got that job. So it was really a crisis of confidence for me when I got that job. The kind of work that I was making, more expressionistic, more fluid, more, less based in observational rendering, was not valued at all at that time there. And so I either had to, so first I had this crisis where I doubt. But then it just...
Can I just ask when that was? Was that before you started teaching or was that that desperate point that you
just... That was the 19th century. No, that was... this was when I first got the job. So this would have been around 2000.
Okay.
Yeah. And...
Immediately preceding getting the job or after getting the job?
Oh, after getting the job.
Okay.
After getting...
So you were in this new environment, yeah. This kind of strange new context, and you found a desperation in terms of prioritizing your right. Okay, that makes
exactly,
all sorts of sense.
Exactly. Yeah. So I either had to, for a brief moment, I tried to fit in.
Mm.
I did. I bought a projector, and I projected some images, and I tried to do some.
You know, this is going out into the world, Catherine. Everyone will know.
It's okay. I'll admit it. I tried to be more like them. I did these realist paintings, photo-based realist paintings.
Interesting.
They're really bad.
Sure.
I think
you still
I
have any of them.
No,
okay.
I don't. But
they're
I think
buried in the backyard somewhere.
I did show them a little bit.
Okay.
But thankfully, it was before the internet was really rolling.
Yeah.
So they don't exist. They don't come up much. But anyway, it was a real crisis of confidence, and I came out of it determined to let things happen more naturally for me from then on, like to really find a way of working that felt authentic, organic, close to my own heart. Not easy. None of those things are, that is not an easy thing to find. It's almost like the harder you try, the less likely it will happen. But I was just, I was so angry and desperate, and I really had hit a bottom there, you know. And this is like a phoenix rising out of the ashes story. I love it. But it really did happen. I got so pissed off and depressed and hated what I was doing so much that that wonderful freeing feeling of almost having nothing to lose feeling. Yeah, that's what it felt like. I have nothing to lose. And it came out of that. It came out of, I'm not wasting my time doing something I don't love ever again. There's really no good reason to be making paintings. There's no practical, you know, logistical, normal life way that you can envision making paintings, especially now. I mean, it's got to be even harder for you know, younger people trying to envision a life as a painter. Because I still had all those romantic cliches to fall back on, the abstract expressionists and the, you know, sitting in a space by yourself with a couple of cigarettes and staring at something and talking about it for hours with your friends. It's like, you know, great stuff.
So that wouldn't have, sorry, this is...
I was digressing. Sorry.
No. So you would agree that by starting this odd teaching job, odd at the time, you had kind of a breakthrough, low-key spiritual awakening of your art. If you didn't take that job, do you think you would be, not trying to get like Gwyneth Paltrow sliding doors here, but do you think you would have found that same kind of realization or joy in the painting? Maybe just it would have taken longer?
I don't know, but maybe not. I mean, I was really challenged. I mean, I really felt like I was brought to my knees. Like, I wanted those guys to love me and love my work and respect me. And I went about it all the wrong way at first. So, yeah.
I just think there's, and I don't want to get too, you know, wacky here, but I've been talking.
It's hard not to.
It's, when you're talking about this stuff, it is, because I've been talking to a few friends of mine who are on the cusp of big decisions, and this just seems like another example of a big decision that, on its face, yeah, it brought you pretty low. You did this thing, you tried to be someone else momentarily based on the importance of the decision, the life change. And I just think that time and time again, that's where change hits, and like really, you can really get a hold of it. And it doesn't have to be like, I think I already made this point, but doesn't have to be a life decision that's based in joy and a great accomplishment and this and that. Often it's the other. Often it's like, oh, it's time to leave New York after 10 years. Oh, it's time to stop teaching or start. You know, it's these really difficult things that like force something to pop out of you. So anyway, I just take that as, I think so many people are panicked by upcoming change and transition. And oh my God, am I going to regret this decision? But I think that inevitably, life change, when you're an artist, this is, why is it reasonable to be an artist? It's probably not. But when you make these changes as an artist, it's kind of amazing how resilient and creative we can be when faced with this.
Yeah. I mean, if you can develop a way of maintaining equanimity in the, you know, in the face of unknown things that are going to hit you, if you can, you know, harness your responses to those things and grow from it. This all sounds like therapy cliche.
Was just going to say,
I'm so sorry.
No, listen, yeah. I started it with all this mumbo jumbo over here.
But I did talk to the students about these things. Like, if you can learn to not freak out and not, you know, become paralyzed by unknown things that happen or roadblocks or things that get in your way or unforeseen tragedies. You know, if you can work through it, really great things can happen. They really can. And yes, in retrospect, I'm grateful for the challenges that I faced because it did open up a way of growing that, again, this is all like about like, yeah, if it doesn't kill you, it makes you stronger.
I thought you were going to say this is all off the record.
No.
Okay, so you said, how we got into this is you said you don't believe in dry periods, or rather you don't have dry periods.
I don't allow myself to have dry
periods. You don't allow. Do you paint every day? And then if so, how long do you paint for every day? And short days, long days, in between? And yeah, let's just start there.
That sounds like lyrics for a beautiful song, Isaac. Short days, long days. When I said I don't allow myself dry periods, that doesn't mean I don't go without working for a few days.
Okay.
I just mean I don't allow that kind of painful, self-torturing, self-defined, like, I'm in a dry period. Like, mm-hmm. That doesn't happen.
Okay.
I do take time to do other things that are, you know, nurturing and enjoyable once in a while. But if you want to just really get down to brass tacks.
Kind of, yeah, sure.
I think 4 hours is like the ideal amount of like really active working time. Like,
that's interesting.
Really, really in the zone working. Four
Does
or five.
Does that not include, sorry to interrupt, but like a pointless hour before or at the end? Or have you kind of extricated the pointlessness from the studio and therefore you go in and on a good day you work 4 hours hard and then you go back to something else outside the studio?
I haven't always been this good. Okay. But I now in my maturity, I am pretty good at, I come in and I work and I don't sit around and like, you know, stare at the wall and have the self-loathing thing, or, you know, I don't really waste time doing that. I do that other places, other times to some degree, but I come in with guns blazing and I do it. Yeah.
You prefer silence in here, or do you,
silence. Or I will sometimes have classical music or jazz or some music that doesn't have lyrics or heart-wrenching kind of emotional human singing.
It takes you out of it. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
Like you can't have something in your head while you're working on this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I like barrios, or, you know, classical guitar or classic jazz, you know, like, Bill Evans piano. That's good. Yeah.
Okay. So we'll take a little break from the painting practice itself, and we will jump to the upcoming show. So how much longer do you have before the work gets sent out? Are we like a couple of weeks out at this point for the LA show?
I just stopped painting 3 days ago, and I'm heading into the exciting wrapping of the work phase.
Oh, so it's done?
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations. It kind
Thank
of
you.
Defeats my question a little bit, but so you are, wow, you're ahead of the deadline? Is
well,
that common?
No, this
for you?
Is the deadline. The work has to go out like within the next 2 weeks or it's not going to make it out.
That's
there.
Still 2 weeks. All right. So speaking as a guy who's hung a painting on a gallery wall
while it's
still dripping.
I'm the same way. No, I've gone into the gallery with my materials and worked in the gallery. Like, yeah. No.
So what's different this time? Are you just so mature that you beyond hit your deadlines, you are like ahead of the game?
The truck is literally going to come like in 10 days and okay. I have to wrap the show. Like, this is not ahead of the game, Isaac.
All right.
Yeah. It opens May 18th. That's like a month, like a little more than a month from now.
Take pity on me because I then meant to interview you 2 weeks ago. Tell me a little bit about the stress in here as that show was coming to the end, meaning, I'm sorry, as the work, as the paintings were getting finished. We've just had a sort of a long exploration of what it takes in here for you to be productive, for you to get your work done. But if you add in that level of panic, stress, anxiety, deadline, whatever it, however it makes you feel, what was the atmosphere in here? How did it change your daily work? Was there any avoiding? Was there any pessimism or fear? I'm curious. Deadlines create difficulty for artists, every artist. So what did you feel, and then how did you deal with it?
The only worse thing than, you know, having a deadline is not having a deadline.
Yeah, that's actually true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Speaking as a man without a deadline.
I'm very grateful to have a deadline for a show, and I just count my blessings every day. You know, it's a good thing. Yeah. And I tell myself that good thing, good thing, good thing. I pretty much always work with the pressure ratcheted up, and that, I mean, that's how I work. There's always this all or nothing feeling to my work. So it's what I'm used to. And it's pretty pretty consistent. So this wasn't always true, but again, by now you think I would have learned how to do this. I've had like 50 shows, you know. So I no longer freak out the way I used to. I'm ready. Like I can consistently kind of work without so much of the, because, but I don't procrastinate. Like I get on it, you know, and I work through it. And I don't let myself get up to the last minute where I'm, you know, in horrible pain and not ready. Because I have done that. Oh, I've done that. And it does not feel good.
I think it's really interesting, that observation that I think I just made in real time, and probably my listeners will have before now, but that the two, even though they seem so different in my head, working to a deadline and your building of the way that you work, how those kind of exist in the same space is really interesting to me, because it really showcases that, I think maybe when this podcast gets a little repetitive, is when I focus too much on good or bad, joy or anxiety, like the sort of polarizing of a studio dynamic, right? Mm-hmm. And I just think it's interesting because the way you described your work was so, you know, bordering on mystical or this thing, right? And then, but in reality, it functions right along the same line as someone who has a deadline and has that sort of, you see what I'm saying? I'm not even putting it into the right words. I just find it so interesting that the two go hand in hand.
Yeah, you wouldn't expect it. Yeah.
Because one feels like you should be, you know, twirling in the woods in the backyard. Right. Versus,
I can only work when I feel, feel it moving
but
me.
You, through your career, through your long career, you have figured out a way to, properly seal or connect those two things together. And I don't mean just deadlines. I mean productivity, I guess is what I mean.
It's also curious and conflicting how things that shouldn't go together can go together. You can make them work for yourself if you can figure out a way of kind of, again, dwelling in this contradictory space where, on the one hand, you're supposed to be free. You're an artist. You're supposed to be unfettered and untethered to the constraints of practicality or money or family dependency and all that stuff. But you're also human. You're living in the real world. I mean, that's why artists love residencies. It's like, get out of the real world and live and make work in this ideal place where no one is allowed to bother you for a month, and they bring you your lunch, and you get the ideal of space and time and an unfettered brain is kind of what I've built for myself over the years. And of course, the isolation of COVID and then cancer, no one's bothering me. I mean, it really, I've had complete focus, almost complete focus on my studio and my work, you know, in a way that I couldn't have had when I was younger or in a different time. And so it's just, it all just kind of blends together in ways that I never could have imagined, if that makes any sense.
No, it does. I've got like four questions I want to ask you all at once, and that's not how mouths work. Do you think, I'll just pick one. Do you think that that gallery owner, curator who came in here and suggested color, do you think that at a different time in your life, you would have stuck with that first impression and been like, the hell with you, this is a compromise, la, la, la? And I'll now make my point is, do you think that now a big part of that is the sort of metaphorical or maybe real excitement at, you know, seeing a person in your meaning, and not that you haven't seen anybody, but having an outside voice come in, make a suggestion, and after all of this isolation that you've had and all of sort of letting yourself be undisturbed and be on your own in here, that there was almost kind of a, like a joyfulness to someone, you know, not just how we put it before, which I still dig. It's an obstacle. It's a challenge.
No, I get it. I get it. You had me at hello. I understand your question. It's a beautiful way of spinning it, of conceiving of it. I hope that's true. And she was literally one of like four people that have been in my studio in like a year and a half. So, you know, literally I was alone. Yeah. Yeah, I think I was more open to the idea of listening to someone else. It had a bit of an enchantment to it. Ooh, like another person's input. Well, why not? And I may not have been as open to it, you know, at another time. Yeah, that's a really intriguing way of seeing it.
What about, did you, and you don't even have to answer this one if you don't want, but speaking to a younger artist, if they were faced with that situation, COVID, we'll leave that out of it, but someone coming into your studio and in, you know, offering you a show, doing that, asking you to change your work a bit to fit the show, at an earlier point in your career, would you advise an artist to, you know, go down fighting, or do you, if would your advice be to go with it, see what happens, and you can also click C for not applicable? I get a lot from artists. I don't like giving advice, which is fair, even though this is all.
I love advice. Giving advice.
Yeah, you do.
I mean, I got paid for it for 21 years.
You
come
sure
on,
did.
Good money. Not really so good, but. Well, the standard advice is, you know, never let a dealer tell you what to do.
Yeah,
like they're not supposed
the
to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every artist, well, maybe a younger artist may not know as easily, but you never want to compromise in a way that is self-effacing or untrue. And you got to learn, you learn to trust your instincts. You, if something feels really wrong, it probably is. But on the other hand, if it's a dealer or a critic or a curator who you have a real rapport with, who you trust, who you have a good feeling about, if they come up with some idea, it might be worthwhile considering. Right. However, the stereotype of like the dealer walking in and saying, oh, I don't want any of these. I want a show of that. It's tough, you know. That's a tough moment. I mean, if it's something that you've already done that you didn't think you wanted to do right now, you might want to consider, well, why not? Like, why not let them, if they want to show this? I mean, trying to talk someone into taking something they don't want is usually not a good idea. Each situation's really different, but I would say don't be completely closed off to a more collaborative model with a curator or a dealer But if it feels really stinky and wrong, it probably is. Yeah.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Because I'm the, you know, master of the segue, you mentioned trust just then, and that's exactly where I want to go. Who do you trust in your studio? Whose voices do you trust? And I'll give a quick anecdote talking to an LA artist who will remain unnamed, as was his wish. He was talking about that he stopped trusting other artists in his studio, and who he trusts is actually his gallery. So he was embracing the voice that is in there to sell your work and to trusting that voice versus trusting an artist's voice who, this is the part I really buy. I think a lot of artists are hard pressed to speak outside of their own aesthetics or their needs from the function of a painting, la, la, la. So if you have an artist who comes in and says, oh, you know, this is interesting, but maybe you could try doing this and this and this. That is what he's saying he no longer trusts and why he actually takes his gallery more at their word. When they say, we could do more mid-sized paintings. I think they function better. And he's like, yeah, I bet that's true. So I know it's been quiet in here, but maybe you can look back at earlier points in your career to answer this if you'd like. Who do you trust most? And this could be your partner, your husband, your friends, your professors. Wait, what's that called? Peers, your faculty. You can laugh at that one too. Who do you trust?
Well, the person I trust the least is my husband.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay. We need to spell that out just a little bit more. Is that because he loves everything you do, hates everything you do, is blind?
Well, he just doesn't realize how legendary and special and what a genius I am. And he's not sufficiently awed by me. So he walks in and he might actually go from here to there and not even stop and say, my God, Catherine, that looks good. Am I asking too much? No, seriously, rarely does my husband come out here because he feels too pressured to be like supportive and positive. And so we just kind of don't do that.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I'm envious of like my artist friends who have the spouse or significant other, partner, what have you, who is just like always tagging along at the openings and always like, God, you're good. I love you. You're amazing. I don't have that kind of a marriage, but he's truthful. So when he does notice and say, then I know that there's something going on. Cause he actually knows. Yeah. So anyway, but yeah, that's it. I've had so many, Isaac, I've had so many studio visits over the years. You can imagine. I mean, they range from wonderful and insightful and life confirming to wretched and paralyzing and my God, why did I let that person in? There's no one category that I would say I trust or not trust. Yeah, it really is case by case, but can I give you a couple of fun like categories they fall into? Okay. Well, there's the artist studio visit where the other artist comes in and pretty much bald-facedly tells you how to make your work more like theirs.
Mm-hmm. Sure. That's what I was, yeah.
That's very common. And it's easy to spot. Don't fall into that hole if you can help it. Once you spot it, just smile, be confident, and you know what's going on, and it's not going to bother you because you can see what's going on, right?
I can think of a certain grad school that used to bring in artists for studio crits, and I would say 90% of those artists that came in were fit a certain rubric that you described, you know?
And that's one of the reasons I am proud of my teaching years, because for the most part, I did not do that.
You did not do that.
I really try to approach the person on their, like in their terms, like what are they trying to do? It's more fun too, to really try to understand like walking in someone else's moccasins. Oh, moccasins, I shouldn't have said. Shoes. Shoes, generic shoes.
I disagree. I agree with that. But from my little teaching at that school, like my TAing, leading a crit when I was, I think a semester or two after you and I worked together, trying to keep that in mind, keep all of their voices in mind, all of the students and their ideas, instead of just bulldozing with my thoughts, I found it to be so exhausting.
It is exhausting.
So tiring, to the point that I always thought teaching would be great until, again, I think I did it for a semester and I thought, it was crit like you and
yeah,
I did.
Yeah.
And it's when you actually care enough to not bulldoze, I think it ratchets up the need, the brain strain.
Oh, I agree. That's why most of them don't bother. They just bulldoze. They just, you know.
It's easier.
Let me tell you how to make a great painting.
For sure.
Because have you seen this?
Let me show you on my phone.
I have the sacred knowledge and I can give it to you.
But, I'm sorry, I derailed you. So that was the first category is those bulldozers.
Yeah, okay. Then these categories are all just variations of the same asshole. Okay, but you know. The second one I can think of is come into your studio and don't actually mention any of the work ever. Now, this may sound difficult, but it's actually possible, and it has happened to me. The building, the curtains, the light, you name it. How's the family? What'd you have for lunch? You know, they are obviously avoiding mentioning the work at all. So, of course, you assume they hate it.
Mm-hmm.
That's another category.
That is.
Yeah.
Normally, I've experienced that, and I do think I just see panic behind their eyes where, you know, it's actually not a problem to come in and you don't get the work or you don't have a foundation with it. You move on. But sometimes it's just disinterest, which is hard to.
Yeah.
Any more categories?
Oh, yeah. Then there's the category of comparing your work to every other artist they can possibly think of with a slight insinuation that all those other artists are better than you and that you remind them of all these better artists they can think of. And they're also just name dropping and proving that they know all these other people. There's that. This is not the majority. I'm giving you the outliers. I mean, the vast majority of the studio visits I've had have been wonderful for one reason or another. And again, it's skill building. You have to learn as an artist how to make the most of what you're given and draw people out and make them comfortable, you know. Well, what do you really think? How great do you really think I am? There are times when you're working when you may not want to have studio visits. Like if you're feeling really excited but also really vulnerable about starting something new, you may not want to have people judging it, you know, and making comments on it when you're right in the thick of it. You may want to keep people away at that point.
No, you're right about that. And that can be the difference between trusting someone and not trusting. It's just could be the same artist both times, but if you're feeling vulnerable, the suggestions can feel a little hostile or a little bit, you know, it's hard to, an artist brain can be kind of a surrounded by landmines and bear traps.
You can also, I mean, I used to also advise students to, you know, take the wheel once in a while. Like, you know, ask your visitor a question, like help set up the studio visit in a way that makes it constructive for you. Instead of just sitting there passively and like letting them say whatever they want about your work, you can actually pose questions as well. You know, the best one though, the best example I can think of that was truly out of this world, I couldn't believe what was happening when it was happening, was an older artist, an older gentleman who, a critic that we both know and admire, suggested that this artist come to my studio and spent an hour and a half while I served him coffee and cookies and stuff talking about his own work and his own career and never mentioned anything about the work that was on the wall in front of him.
That
I handled it. Isaac, I was so polite and nice. I let him talk about himself for an hour and I was just like, thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, well, I really hope that you'll return the favor and come to my studio. I said, well, we don't really have to. We just spent an hour and a half talking about your work. Goodbye. Yep.
Well, you weren't
but,
wrong.
But there are times when it's wonderful to just, even if it's random, even, you know, it's wonderful to get feedback, you know. And there are other, like I said, there are other times when you don't want it. You really want to hunker down, shut your doors, pull your blinds down. I mean, isn't that part of the reason we become painters in the first place, is to spend time alone? I want to be alone. Yeah.
Yeah, me too these days. So listen, Now we can talk about either how artists can take better care of themselves or depression.
Oh,
now,
Jesus.
That second one seems to be more in line with what we were talking about. But you know what? As a master of the segue, I'm going to zig instead of zag. How would you... I'm sorry, this is a pretty general question. But for younger artists, artists just getting started, throw a couple of... darts at the wall about how they might, not talking about get a better career or get more successful, but this could be in terms of mental health or just general well-being. How can young artists, do you think, what could they do, something that they could do where they would take a little better care of themselves? You saw a lot of students over the years at the academy and outside of the academy. Anything that you saw those during that period of time that you just wanted to kind of shake a kid and be like, you know, don't work with turpentine or don't eat your paint or perhaps
don't
something.
Don't set your studio on fire.
I did that once actually at
so
UW.
I.
Yeah,
I'm
I got in so much
I'm
trouble.
I'm in a book about artists who set their work on, their studios on fire.
Really?
Yes.
It was a school studio, so I did get in a lot of trouble. And it didn't like burn to the ground.
I set the second floor of my wooden, my 18th century wooden house on fire.
I remember that.
Oily rags,
That was recently, right?
Yeah.
Or not terribly recently.
That was like 16 years ago.
Oh, okay. I must have just heard the story recently.
I tell it as often as I can because it's a good story.
All right. Well, first of all, I love the idea for this book and you have to include me.
No, it's already been published. I'm in the book.
Like, oh, you're in the book.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like the only coffee table art book that I'm in. It's the book about artists who've burned down their studios. It's better than nothing, Isaac.
I'm
so out of touch with what young people are feeling right now. I'm not sure I can really comment on it or help them very much.
What about the gallery game? I mean, that's changed over the years, and I'm not asking for all of your gallery experiences, but don't you think that there are more, do you think that it might be a tougher place to come into as a younger artist now? Or do you think that actually hasn't, meaning we spoke a little bit beforehand about, you know, me getting bamboozled here or there. And, you know, it's happened to a lot of artists, but do you think that that is more common these days, or that's just part of my sense of
things is that almost everything is worse. I mean, the world is truly in peril in so many ways, and there are so many more. Just the sheer numbers of artists, young artists coming out of art programs. When I emerged from my MFA and moved to New York, it was like a small town by comparison. I mean, people were in physical space together. Nobody had phones they were staring at. You'd see, you know, the same, like, 150 people was the art world. It was the scale of things has just exploded exponentially. And the way that images are perceived has changed. The way that objects are perceived has changed. The whole role of, you know, an artist's life, what it's dedicated to, I'm like rubbing my eyes. I can't believe how much has changed. So it's very hard for me to speculate on if I were 25 years old, how I would maneuver at this point. It's really hard to say for me.
How about, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but before we were on mic, we were talking about a certain American sensibility and perhaps the American artist sensibility where we all kind of want everything, you know, we want to have our cake and eat it too, kind of perspective. Do you think that there's a charitable way of looking at this, or do you think that this could be pointed at as sort of something that we have overcorrected to, that we have sort of missed the boat on? Do you mind talking a little bit about this?
It's such a big topic.
I mean,
Olympic athletes are like, I'm not going to compete because I don't really feel good about myself. And this whole permission to not compete, permission to not strive. It of course there's a good side to it. Of course there's it sounds really mentally healthy and part of me wishes that I'd come up in that kind of sensibility instead of the one that I did come up in. However, I've, you know, like the adversity that I faced and the drinking that I did and the unhealthy things that I did, pushing and pushing and pushing to raise myself out of the humdrum, you know, beginnings I had in life and move to New York and try to be a visual artist, took a lot of tenacity and a lot of suffering and a lot of work. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't pushed that hard. Did I pay a price for it? You know, very probably. Did I give myself cancer because of the stress? Maybe. But I didn't understand any other way of doing it. But I can see now that, you know, there's been a seismic shift, that this, you know, younger generation is not willing to suffer or doesn't see the kind of reward ratio, suffering reward ratio the same way. And it's, I can't say if there's overcorrection or what, if it's good or bad, but it's certainly very different. And people of my generation or older are certainly going to scoff at it to some degree because it's so, you know, it's so easy to make fun of in a way.
Yeah, of course.
But there, of course, there's some good in it. There's some truth in it. And boy, once you get sick, you know, brings it home. It's like, let's see now. If I'm not alive, I can't make work. So maybe taking care of my physical body and my mental health and my physical health could be a good thing. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, of course.
Like,
I mean,
maybe drinking myself to death or, you know, or going off a bridge like Pollock did with, you know, a bunch of young women in the car. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's not a great way to go.
It's not as cool as de Kooning made it look in that book. This will be the last like super nebulous question for you, or rather question about generational differences, which I try not
to harm. You're making me sound like I'm 90.
I know. And you are not, but you're from a different generation than me. And it is the elephant in the room. No, I'm just kidding. But here's the question. I was just editing a conversation with the artist Ann Harris, and she said something that really stuck with me. The line was something like, art, she wants art to matter less and artists to matter more. I mean, I think it was a very clever riff on the title of this podcast. But the idea that what she sees, I think she was talking about growing up, but she was talking about now. The idea that we as the makers are so undervalued when in relation to the art we make, because the art is the thing with the dollar signs and we are just the people that make it. And I do agree with her that there is that separation. And I just wondered if that is something you think was, you are as familiar with as I am coming up when you did. Do you feel like the artist was also sort of, it was such, the art world was so money oriented. Is that the full experience you've had with it too? Or do you also notice a bit of an inching towards, or a, you know, 100-mile sprint towards, we are just making commodities to make rich people richer and la, 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 la. Not saying that that is the voice in our heads while we're in the studio, but the...
Well, our art has always been that.
It has.
And yeah, it's something we don't like to think about. I spent my whole life working for non-for-profits. You know, I've been in these like warm, fuzzy, you know, artist run spaces. And I mean, I feel very fortunate to have been, to kind of come of it, to grow up, when I say grow up between like, you know, grad school and now, like, I was at Hall Walls in Buffalo, you know, for 6 years, one of the first non-for-profit artist run spaces. We were putting on shows and, you know, getting grant money and very much outside of the commercial gallery circuit, you know, and just, it was wonderful. And then I came to New York and I was associate director at White Columns with Bill Arning for many years. And, you know, again, not-for-profit, it was all about the ideas and the work and the people, and it was very community oriented, and people didn't have smartphones yet. It was like, so it was very like visceral and human and local, locavore. And so I'm really grateful. I mean, I'm not grateful to be as old as I am, which you keep putting on how old I am, but I am grateful that I was an emerging artist at a time when it really was so much more about the artists and about community and creativity and the thrill of being in a place and a time and making things. But of course, we all wanted to sell our work and show in galleries too. I mean, there's always contradiction in there. And of course, one way, painters are the worst. I mean, as painters, you know, we are making the ultimate commodity fetish thing. My colleagues in the nonprofit world, like the ones that could be really sanctimonious, were like the performance artists and the ones who are doing more ephemeral forms of art that couldn't be, you know, purchased as readily. So there was always a bit of hypocrisy for painters to pretend that they're there, because you're making an object. You know, you're making a hopefully a beautiful, transcendent, special object that, even though it's part of some kind of commercial transaction, will end up being gazed upon by someone or generations of someone's family, and it will bring good things to the people that are looking at it. I mean, that sounds so incredibly romantic, but isn't that what we're trying to do? Like, make an object that inspires someone to look at it for a long time and maybe make them happier or intrigued or feel something they may not have felt. It's certainly not, we're not just trying to make a decoration. We're trying to do something, but it gets really confusing and quagmire-like to consider how all the moving pieces kind of fit together over the course of a career. And that's another reason that I left my teaching job at 60, which is not ancient as professors go. Professors,
I still just tricked you into talking about the good old days. So my work here is done.
No, but I'm just saying, like, part of the reason I left teaching at 60, which is the new 50, by the way, is I was really becoming self-conscious about giving advice about certain things, because I'm like, you know what? It's changing really fast. And I used to send out pieces of paper that was called a CV and was on paper. And, you know, like, we used to have sheets of slides, and I was just worried that my, you know, pompous advice could be completely wrong at this point, you know? Boy, the good old days.
The good old days. So I really like what you just said, and I had an addition that I heard recently, and I want your take on it, that the meaning of the work, as much as we write our artist statements, you being the one who kind of showed me how to write an artist statement, I think you might in particular find this interesting, as much as we work on all that and think about all that, meaning, this is the quote, meaning is what happens to your art over time. It's not your career, meaning how well you do. It's how your art exists, like the context it exists in. It is the narrative of the art making that you yourself achieve through your life that is the meaning of it. And I know that actually the way I phrased it sounds a little frou-frou again, but I don't mean it in that way, because I think that whatever our instigating force is, whatever the artist statement says, that's what gets us out of bed in the morning. That's what gets us in the studio, la, la, la. That's very important. But I like that idea that as much as we think about it, meaning and art, it's more of like a historical conversation. And therefore, there's like a potential for your art to be even more than you are. And I just feel like that sort of parallels a bit of your last response. And I personally like it. I was curious if you...
Yeah, I mean, we're all hoping to transcend our boring selves by making these objects that are greater than we are. Like, we're all playing God. Like, why else would we be doing something that's so weird and difficult? Yeah. And you know, it's what we may not admit it, but it's what we're all aspiring towards. I mean, not all, I shouldn't speak for everyone, but a lot of painters, let's put it that way, a lot of painters.
Right.
Some painters. Painters that matter. Painters that I like. Over time, but again, we're living in a moment an unprecedented moment where even history has become suspect, and we're canceling a lot of great figures that we thought were important figures in history, and the whole idea of trajectory and history and validity, all those things are being so questioned right now. It's hard to even conceive of placing yourself as an artist in history.
Mm. Yeah, in history, you're right. You're absolutely right.
Will there be a future? Will there be history if there's no future? Or what kind of future is coming, and what kind of history will it require?
Don't you make my head spin.
Which is why, you know, coming into a white, empty studio, or maybe not so white anymore, but and turning off those huge philosophical and apocalyptic, you know, questions and visions, and making something. I love that painting can be both things. It can be like you said, the sort of workmanlike craft process where, you know, you and I could talk for 2 hours about which reds are the best pigments, and we can do shop talk about all this like geeky like paint stuff.
Yeah,
there's that side of it, and then there's this like other side of it, which is, you know, it's aspiration to being, you know, philosophical or spiritual or connected to life in some way, important in some way, that's larger than, you know, mere craft. I mean, you get this wide spectrum and even seemingly contradictory definition of what it even is.
No, you're absolutely right. And I love that point. I think that's such a, yeah, it's so wide spanning. Come on, why is it? Obviously, it's the most interesting thing we could be doing. But there's a third part that just jumped into my mind with your show Around the Corner. So what we just compared right there was us sitting around and talking about the nuts and bolts versus the sort of wider picture, the context with which it might one day be seen in. What about the third outlet or the third role, which is the artist still alive, still present, in the gallery with the art on the walls, schmoozing and explaining the work and doing all that? With the show right around the corner, do you feel comfortable and at ease in the environment that you're shortly going into? You've done it a lot of times. And have you always been comfortable there? Does it take something from you? And was there anything along the way that helped you? Because say what you will, the shop talk, the joy of that is, for many of us, I'll speak for myself, inherently, I didn't have to learn to have a blast with that. Galleries, talking to these people, doing that, I'm still learning how to be comfortable. How do you feel about it now, and how's it changed over the span of your career?
For one thing, I don't expect to be comfortable. Like, if I am comfortable, I feel lucky.
Interesting.
But I've learned to accept that there are many times where I'm not going to be comfortable, and that's okay, and that's part of it.
Mm. And we're not, I think the listener already gets it, but we're not talking about, oh, you're not comfortable because it's a shady gallery, or it's, you don't know, things like that. It's about a comfort with a situation, which you are just, again, inherently, you're inevitably not comfortable in. That's what we're talking about.
Because you're exposed, you're vulnerable.
You are exposed.
Yeah, you're exposed, you're vulnerable. Your creations are around you. You're a sitting duck. You're there, you know, either maybe people are lavishing praise on you. That feels good. I mean, it's all, well, this, you know, on a very personal level, this opening is going to be very difficult for me because I've been alone for a long time. I haven't done it in a while. I had two solo shows in the past 2 years that I did not attend the opening because I couldn't. And I'm going to be the only one with a mask on, and I'm going to, you know, we mentioned the cancer in my press release and of how this work has come out of a kind of period of intense, recovery. So I'm going to be very exposed, like very vulnerable, very exposed.
And I would assume that, sorry to interrupt, but from our talk today, you don't seem to want to be leading with that experience. And at the same time, you're going to be showing work that surrounds and embodies that experience.
Well, I put it in the press release. So
right. But that doesn't...
Yeah,
but
I came up with it. Yeah.
For me, that's you being honest and factual versus like you want to tell everyone at this show all about your...
No.
You know, your health.
No,
your,
I don't. Yeah.
So you're... I get that. So you're saying that... It's okay to be uncomfortable.
Yeah. And again, it's like part of the kind of mixed, it's sort of the duality of it. I mean, it's kind of thrilling to be uncomfortable in a way. I mean, being comfortable all the time is really boring.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, some weirdo comes up to you at your opening and says something off the wall. I mean, yeah, it might hurt a little or it might irritate you a little or... Maybe people don't seem to love it as much as you'd hoped, or all that roller coaster of up and down and unknown. It's all kind of great compared with like working as a dental hygienist or something. Sorry, and there's a lot of great people that do that, I'm sure. But
I actually have a large portion of bit of my listenership is dental hygienist, so I'd like to announce an apology from myself and Catherine Howe to all of those listeners.
Actually, we all appreciate a good dental hygienist. It really makes all the difference.
It does make all the difference.
I'm sorry. That was a bad example, but this is what we signed up for. We signed up for trying to do something that's kind of nervy and crazy and putting it out there and letting people judge us. That's what we're doing. And it can go in so many different directions. Will there even be galleries in 10 years where people stand there and I don't know. I mean, I guess there will. I do love the fruition where of the project where the work is not just on Instagram. The work is not just a digital reproduction. Like there it is. It's in a space and you're standing in a space with other people. And that's pretty great. That's pretty great. No matter what happens, it's pretty great. I keep telling myself that. Like whatever happens, it's good. It's better than not doing it.
Of course.
Yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. And if someone buys my work and lives with it, see, I'm at that level where I'm not in the huge like speculation investment, like the fancy art collectors that are like, you know, speculating on hot young artists and warehousing their work and stuff like that. I'm not in that world.
When you sell a painting, it's going to sit somewhere and be appreciated versus rolled
up.
Yeah,
my prices aren't high enough for that. I mean, my work is selling to like real people who have enough money that they want to live with real art, but they're not like in the high end collector's realm, you know? And so chances are they're not going to put it up for auction the next year. Like they're going to live with it and make, you know, pass it down to their daughter or whatever. I kind of have made peace with that. Like that's okay with me. I mean, it's kind of nice. It's kind of a moderate level of craziness. Like, you know, the fact that like a student of mine would graduate and their work would be selling for five times more than mine, like within a year. Like the art world is, it's absolutely nuts. I mean, prices are all over the place and some people are huge market phenomenons and then just fall out completely. I mean, it can go in so many directions that I'm just going to be grateful for standing in a real space with real people, with my work on the wall. Like that's about as far as I can think right now. And I'm really grateful for it.
Catherine, I have more questions and I want to talk to you about everything, but maybe I think we should leave it there for now. And I wish you luck on this show. I wish I could be in LA to see it. And thanks for talking with me. It's like old times again, huh?
Thank you, Isaac. You did with one of your other interviews, you said something like, and in addition to all of her other incredible accomplishments, the best thing she did was to be my professor or my teacher. I forgot who it was. Oh, it was Jennifer Coates.
It was Coates.
Who's amazing.
Do you want the same
I want you to say that to me, yeah.
Deal. All right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that was my conversation with the artist Catherine Howe. If you'd like to find out more about her work, check out the links in the episode description and find her website at CatherineHoweArtist.com. Catherine with a C and Howe with an E. For those of you listening, as the episode releases, Catherine's show at Von Lintel Gallery opens in Los Angeles on May 18th and runs through July 6th. As always, you can check me out, as well as listen to older episodes of Art Matters at isaacman.com, which is spelled with two A's and two N's. In celebration of hitting the 30-episode mark, I launched the official Art Matters Patreon account earlier this week. Please consider supporting the podcast. Your hard-earned cash will directly support future episodes and keep this puppy running. You can also help by spreading the word and sharing these episodes with your friends, especially to folks in academia who could help get this podcast bouncing around in art schools. If you have any questions about the podcast, drop me a line at artmatterspodcast@gmail.com. Thank you all so much for listening. New episodes of Art Matters, the podcast for artists, drop every other Thursday. See you next time.
I agree. Can I use that sound in the intro?
Yeah. I can do a good turkey call. Do you know the people used to make their living as turkey callers around here?
Yeah.
Go, go, go.
Pretty cool.
Okay, now. Okay.
I like your hair.
Thank you. I actually finally found, I'm 37 and I finally found the person who gives me a great haircut.
That's like, beautiful.
I don't want to call her a barber. That's why I'm getting tongue-tied. She's called a stylist.
A hair stylist.
A hair designer.
Hair designer.
She's great. Sarah Saleem. For those people in Detroit, she knows what she's doing. She's a rock star, actually. Like, actually a rock star.
I believe it.
Anyway, Catherine, let's stay on topic.